Welcome to the latest episode of Tax Crime Junkies. In today's show, we delve into the perplexing world of tax fraud, where even successful professionals can resort to deceit and betrayal. Our focus today is on 34-year-old Paul Henry Harleman, a contract bookkeeper who used his professional knowledge and relationships to defraud his clients. Over the course of 4 years, from July 2018 through May of 2022, he managed to steal more than $1.2 million from small businesses and nonprofit organizations before he was finally caught and detained. Now, in a court of law, Paul was found guilty of 6 counts of wire fraud and 8 counts of money laundering. Special Agent in Charge John F. Tobin of Homeland Security Investigations Honolulu worked on the case, and he commented that Mr. Harleman was motivated by greed as he heartlessly stole thousands of dollars from small businesses and nonprofit organizations. In this episode, we explore the intricate details of Paul's fraudulent scheme and how he managed to carry it out for so long. We'll also take a closer look at the impact of his actions on the businesses and organizations that he victimized, as well as the consequences he faced as a result of his crimes. So join us as we unravel the mysteries of this intriguing case and uncover the motivation behind Paul's deceitful actions. We'll also examine why small businesses and nonprofit organizations are more vulnerable to fraud and the measures that can be taken to prevent it. Stay tuned for an eye-opening episode of Tax Crime Junkies. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tax Crime Junkies, the podcast about true tax crimes. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA, certified tax strategist. I have an interest in true crimes, and I have a degree in law and lead the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners. And with me today is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Thanks, Dom. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I've admitted to practice before the United States Tax Court. And like Dominique, I'm also a tax instructor and have a real interest in true crime.
That's right. So we decided to create a true crime podcast to combine our love of mysteries and whodunits. We are the Tax Crime Junkies. Are you excited to get into this one?
Oh, I am. And I think we should get into it right now. Paul Henry Harleman had an impressive professional background. He was working as an accountant and also working in the office of the Hawaiian aide, Kelly Akina. In addition, he was a contract bookkeeper at Precision Accounting Firm. Originally from Cameroon, Paul obtained his green card after an extensive stay in the United States.
That's right, Tom. And this is going to come up later on in our description of the case. At Precision Accounting, Paul's work involved assisting clients in building and reviewing accounting systems and managing the procedures that formed the basis of their accounting operations. His expertise and personable disposition earned him a solid reputation in the industry, and his clients often gave him praise for being easy to work with, helpful, kind, trustworthy, and knowledgeable. So Paul's charm and broad smile may have been the key to his success in luring small business owners who were trying to establish themselves. However, in 2018, Paul's reputation was tarnished when he embarked on his first scam, ultimately leading to his downfall. So let's get into his first time, Tom.
Well, what we think is his first time, Dominique. At a certain point in his relationship with one of his clients, Paul's greed got the better of him. Having gained their trust and observed their business success, he used his access to their accounts to study them closely. He identified which clients and vendors were significant, and then sadly used this information to prey on his client. To carry out this scheme, Paul established a limited liability company called Pacific Media Group, What made this act particularly insidious was that he ensured the name of the LLC was similar to one of his client's vendors. This enabled him to charge his client's credit card for invoices using the name of the closely named vendor. So between July 2018 and May 2020, Paul was able to fraudulently charge his client up to $146,000, diverting the funds into the LLC bank account. This was a clear, callous disregard of his client's trust and is a testament to show how far he'd be willing to manipulate his client for his own gain.
So this is really recent, Tom. I mean, May 2020, that's during the pandemic.
Right.
Did any of those ERC claims or PPP frauds?
Right. It was about that time when it seemed like the federal government was handing out so much money and people were experiencing financial hardship. And so they were looking for cash. Whether or not that was motivating Paul, I guess we'll never know.
And maybe it might be that his scheme seemed to be working so well for him. But I've got to say, Tom, Paul sank deeper into his second fraud scheme after he had some success defrauding his client of the $146,000 and he didn't raise suspicion. Paul then became emboldened and more brazen in his fraudulent activities. He knew he had to maintain his limited liability company because it was an essential tool in his arsenal. So his new scheme involved targeting two clients who had more substantial funds, and he began transferring money in batches to his own LLC. What he did here is he disguised those sums as part of a payroll that his LLC was owed by the two clients. So from September of 2019, he was able to defraud both of these clients of over $1.64 million through this so-called payroll scheme. Now, one of the businesses that he targeted was a small landscaping company in Oahu, Hawaii, and that company had hired Paul to manage their accounts. In this situation, he siphoned over $415,000 from the business, all under the guise of quote-unquote payroll.
Wow.
So to cover his tracks, he moved the funds from his personal checking account to his personal investment account. He's trying to put distance between this paper trail of the money, right? He's transferring it more than once to hopefully conceal it more. And just like you said, Tom, Paul's actions demonstrated a clear, callous disregard for the livelihoods of the small business owners that he victimized. You know, he used their trust in him to perpetuate his fraudulent schemes. And it really does highlight the vulnerabilities that all small businesses have to financial crimes. You know, people are busy. They don't often have an expertise in the numbers of the business or running the business itself. And they turn that trust to who they think is a reputable advisor. And this is the real crime here. That violation of trust has a ripple effect on our profession. People trust us with their most vulnerable secrets, and that extends far beyond their finances. Have you ever had anyone share something super private with you, Tom?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Private information is just part and parcel of tax world, Dominique, right?
Yeah.
It's not even, you know, a simple preparation of a basic tax return discloses tremendous amounts of personal info to the preparer of that return.
It's very vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
It's that people have this, they feel personally about their finances. I often meet with people who feel embarrassed or shame around the condition of their finances, whether they have a lot of money or not. Sometimes they're very embarrassed to either not know more about the situation or that they aren't as organized as maybe they think they should be.
Right. I mean, just for a simple tax return, you know, whether it's personal or business, we get copies. I get, you know, canceled checks for direct deposit of tax refunds. You might get bank statements, which shows what purchases they've bought, disclosing more accounts potentially that they have, who their vendors are. In my past and current life in doing tax controversy, it actually is even more personal because a lot of people with tax problems have had severe financial and personal issues in the past that are very difficult to discuss or disclose. And even just opening up about them so they can get right with their tax situation makes them very vulnerable to me as the professional.
Yeah, definitely. And that gets them to open up about other areas of their life. You know, I once had someone call me and inquire as to how to post bail.
Oh my God.
You know, I guess maybe I should know that. I don't know. And yet somebody else who shared with me the photos of her husband that she found online on a dating site where he was having an affair. That is real vulnerability. And the violation of that trust is really damaging. So I want to also share with folks how to protect yourselves from these types of breaches. Trust, but with validations.
You know, exactly, Dominique. When you validate, you empower yourself to ensure you're trusting the right process and trusting the right people. The problem with people is that people are fallible.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, somebody that may be trustworthy today may turn out to not be trustworthy in the future. We're telling the story of Paul, and we're assuming these were his first times. But there was a first time at one point. But when you assert good internal controls, that's going to allow you to be positive that you're trusting the right people, because not everybody has your best interest at heart.
Absolutely. At a minimum, when you engage a professional who has access to or manages your finances, you should be reviewing the output, reviewing the statements, so that everything just seems correct. It can't be a blind reliance or blind faith that puts you at risk for these types of frauds and schemes. But Dominique, like all of our stories we cover in this podcast, his deeds did eventually catch up with him. At this point, Paul was actually already on the authorities' radar. Special agents had gathered information about his fraudulent actions and decided to approach the victim. Now, during their conversation, the victim denied any knowledge of Paul's LLC and had disclosed that he had access to their payroll account software. The victim then made a call to Paul, which was recorded with mutual agreement. During the call, Paul initially denied the allegations, but eventually admitted to having a company and making some payments. He claimed the money was being invested in, get this, Bitcoin, and promised to sort it all out. He agreed to meet with the victim that evening, but of course, he failed to show up and then quickly became unreachable afterwards. It actually turns out he was attempting to flee the state of Hawaii. He told one of his clients who was a victim of his crimes that he was headed of all places to the Netherlands. That doesn't sound very exciting to me, Dominique. If I was fleeing from a life of crime, I don't think it would be the Netherlands. Where would you head?
That's a good question. I think, number one, it would have to be a warm location with a beach for me to consider hiding out anywhere. Where would you go?
I don't know. Somewhere on a mountain, maybe. You know, it's going to be some elevation, some good views, and very hard to find me. So Henry didn't go to any of these places, of course, because unbeknownst to Henry, Homeland Security was already aware of what was going on and apprehended him shortly after he attempted to leave the state.
Whew, Tom. Contrary to popular belief, there was nothing particularly unique about the companies that fell victim to Paul Henry's fraudulent schemes. They were simply like any other organization that had hired somebody with technical and professional expertise to manage their accounts. And unfortunately, instances of accounting scandals and corporate malfeasance, they're not that uncommon, even in larger corporations like Tyco and Enron. But the thing is, in smaller organizations, individuals like Paul are more likely to get away with fraudulent activity for extended periods of time. According to a 2002 survey conducted by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, small businesses experience fraud at a rate 200 times higher than that of large businesses, and their losses are typically around $100,000. What's even more alarming is that over 75% of these frauds go undetected or unreported. So it is possible that Paul had been involved in a smaller fraudulent scheme or schemes prior to the bigger ones, but those companies may not have ever even noticed, or maybe they just didn't report them. So we're definitely going to get into how to protect yourself as a small business owner so you don't feel like a sitting duck for unscrupulous advisors to prey on. But let's start, Tom. Why did this happen? Why does it happen?
It's true that limited resources and a reliance on outside staff can make small businesses and nonprofits vulnerable to fraud. These organizations just may not have the manpower or funds to conduct comprehensive fraud prevention control or audits, making it easier for someone like Paul to commit fraud undetected.
One of the most popular cases is a 2002 case involving Denise Inaba. Denise was an accountant who got charged with 170 cases of theft from her employer. So while she was working part-time at Jaspo Inc., she wrote fraudulent checks reaching $1,200 to herself. And over time, that piled up to $4.6 million. It went on for 8 years. So like Paul, she was the sole bookkeeper of the business. She wasn't a full-time employee, and she kept making fake entries to cover her tracks.
Just like that. Common fraud schemes in these types of organizations include billings from fraudulent vendors, padding expense reimbursement reports, issuing fake refunds, and stealing corporate checks and cash. These fraudulent activities often go undetected or unreported, which can lead to significant losses for the organization. For example, I just know a colleague who had corporate checks that she mailed taken out of a mailbox, altered, and then fraudulently deposited into somebody else's account.
This happens
more than you know. While it may make sense for these organizations to rely on outside bookkeepers due to a lack of in-house accounting knowledge, it's important to ensure that proper controls and reviews are in place to prevent fraud. Financial statements can reveal a lot about a company, and a contracted bookkeeper can have even more knowledge about the business than some of the owners or the management team. It's really essential for small businesses and nonprofits to prioritize fraud prevention and detection to protect themselves from significant losses.
You know, Tom, let's just pause and talk specifically about good controls that small business owners can take to protect themselves. It doesn't actually require becoming an expert in accounting. You can still come to rely on that expertise, but there are several internal control measures that a small business can use to prevent fraud. One of the most effective ways to do that is to separate or segregate accounting duties. So this means separating the various functions of accounting, like the bookkeeping, the payroll, the financial statement preparation, and you assign each of those tasks to different individuals. Now, if you're in a really small company, you may not have the luxury of having three or four different people that you can assign these tasks to. So you can separate essential components of each of these areas. So for example, one employee can be responsible for bookkeeping, while another handles accounts payable and accounts receivable. someone else signs the checks. You could have a separate person that's responsible for getting and opening the mail. When you separate these duties, it ensures that no single person has complete control over a financial transaction and from the beginning through the end. And that's what reduces the risk of fraud. Again, it could just be something as simple as not allowing check signing authority to your bookkeeper. They can process the accounts payable, they can prepare the checks to be signed, but when it comes time to sign those checks, that resides with the business owner or office manager. It could also be keeping control over those checks so that you have a check log, you distribute those checks when it's necessary, but you know each time how many checks you're letting go of.
Spare checks should be secured and locked away. And that's something I've also had colleagues who have had checks stolen from their office. And in that case, when the checks are stolen, it's easy to commit fraud on the bank account.
Absolutely. And as we move away from the paper activities and more into electronic banking, you know, it could just be as simple as stealing the bank account information, the routing number and the account number. And so when you think about even just separating who receives the bank statements so that the person who's committing the fraud doesn't also receive the bank statements so that they can hide it. So you want to just, as much as you can, limit how much access any single person has to the entire process. The person who's cutting checks or opening the mail shouldn't also be the person that's recording the accounting transactions. As we're seeing so far with Paul Henry, he's able to go in, sort of doctor the recording of the accounting processes so that he can make it say whatever he wants. Another measure is to conduct regular audits of financial records. And it doesn't have to be some formal extensive audit. That can be expensive. But simple use of technology that provides what we call audit trails can be really helpful. What an audit trail does is it helps to identify changes and inconsistencies in financial records. And that can help just point to potential fraudulent activity. So just as an example, if you're a small business owner and you look at the audit trail once a month, you'd be able to see what transactions are being changed. If it's not frequent or if it's not following a pattern, you can move on. But if you notice something, sometimes just asking questions can deter someone from theft, just knowing that someone is checking. And it's just sort of like those signs that you put in your yard or stickers on the window, Tom, that say you have a home alarm system. It's that act of deterrent that sometimes just keeps you safe.
That's right. And we often underestimate the value of deterrence. Simply having your accountant prepare checks, but having the owner or manager can be being the signer can make a big difference. The person in charge of recording the books, accessing the bank statements, and signing or making payments electronically can deter somebody from even trying it.
Small businesses can also implement a policy of requiring two signatures for checks above a certain threshold. And that just ensures that no single person can write a large check without the approval of another person. But in cases, unfortunately, like Denise and Abba, that wouldn't necessarily have helped. She was writing checks at $1,200 a pop, and it was just over time that it added up to big dollar amounts. But again, requiring that oversight could mitigate the amounts that someone can steal.
Receiving statements elsewhere and regular reviews of bank statements and credit card statements can also help to identify fraudulent activity. This simply involves looking at the transactions listed on the statements, look at the transactions recorded in the accounting system, and determining if they line up.
Just asking those questions like, gosh, why was our payroll so high? Or why was our office supplies expense so high? Oh, gee whiz, there's a charge to Nordstrom on here. What is that related to? Finally, it's important for small businesses to establish a code of ethics and provide training to employees on fraud prevention. This can include educating employees on warning signs of fraud and encouraging them to report any suspicious activity. I had a client once whose prior accountant had embezzled, and you know what brought her down? The secretary kept noticing her expensive shoes and handbags and told the business owner.
Wow. They
knew that her salary level could not afford those designer name brands. And so they later had her arrested on theft. I actually testified in that trial.
Well, speaking of getting arrested, in April of 2021, Paul was arrested and detained for committing 6 counts of wire fraud and 8 counts of money laundering, all federal crimes. He pled guilty, but not without some drama. His attorney actually withdrew from the case in August of 2021 due to a breakdown in the attorney-client relationship. Paul got a new attorney in September, but he sought to change them in January of 2022, claiming that she'd ignored all his attempts to communicate. He went through 3 lawyers before his actual guilty plea, if that tells you anything about how difficult a client he was.
We think we have difficult clients at times, Tom. Reading his emails to his attorneys, Paul Henry sounds like a Karen. Here's an example of one of his emails to the judge. Since this initial email, I have not heard back from Crystal. I've emailed her 14 times on the following dates, and I have not received a response from her. September 23rd, the 28th, October 1st, the 5th, the 14th, the 18th, the 21st, again on the 21st, the 22nd, the 24th, the 28th, November 10th, 11th, 26th, and finally December 3rd. I also called her office repeatedly during the September to December time period and mailed her 2 letters with a specific request to reach out to me before January 2022 to discuss my case. The last time I spoke to Crystal was 30 minutes before I was formally indicted on October 21st of 2021. During this brief call, she pledged to either call or visit me the following week, which she didn't do.
Well, this sounds like some former tax clients I've had, that's for sure. It also sounds definitely entitled, considering he's getting free counsel. Keep in mind, Henry tried to flee the country. Now, while in jail, he had a number of calls with the consulate of the Netherlands. Harleman claimed that the consulate representative explained to him the current treaty that exists between the Netherlands and the United States. He was also informed that the Netherlands would cooperate with the United States in extradition proceedings based on the charges in this case if he attempted to seek refuge in the Netherlands. Experts suggested that Paul's charges could have resulted in a sentence of about 20 years imprisonment for each wire fraud charge and up to 10 years for each money laundering charge. We would do the math. That's a lot of time.
No wonder he was trying to get to the Netherlands. But it sounds like the Netherlands isn't going to take him.
I don't think they want him.
No, I don't think they want him either. Let's talk about wire fraud, because sometimes this confuses people if bank wires were not used in the crime. But what we mean by wire fraud is that it's a form of white-collar crime, and it involves using an interstate device to defraud victims of money, property, and other valuables. So this is an age-old description of crime long before we had email and things of that source, but it does cover emails. So in Paul's case, he reviewed documents, he created an LLC, he communicated with clients via the phone, via email, and in person, all in the course of his fraudulent acts. So that caused him to be guilty of wire fraud. And according to the U.S. Department of Justice, there's a wire fraud statute, and there's 4 elements that have to be present for a case to be considered wire fraud. The most important element there is that the defendant had to have an intent to commit fraud, or they had to have participated in a scheme to get money from another person. Also, the defendant must have used interstate wire communications at any point in time. So again, wire is not just a financial transfer device. Wire is telephone. Wire is email. Anytime that you're speaking to somebody via that line of communication. Now, although his sentencing was scheduled for August of 2022, he wasn't actually sentenced until just a few weeks ago, Tom. The court also ordered the forfeiture of money in his accounts, and his Hawaiian credit union account actually had more than $1.2 million in it in total. So that's what he sacrificed. They confiscated that. He ended up being sentenced to 64 months in federal prison and had restitution owed of $1.2 million. Now, here's where his origin story comes in. Since Paul Henry is from Cameroon, he also faces deportation after completing his sentence.
And Dominique, that ultimate price is really warranted, I think, in this case. The abuse of the fiduciary relationships between client and accounting professionals is serious. It undermines the trust that society places in these individuals. The credentials and ethical codes of conduct that these professionals are required to have and abide by demonstrate the gravity of their role in handling financial information and resources on behalf of clients. Paul's story serves as a sobering reminder of the consequences of not upholding ethical standards. As you pointed out, accounting professionals have access to sensitive financial information that can make them vulnerable to temptation and greed. It's important for professionals to regularly reflect on their ethics and values to ensure they're operating with integrity and always in the best interest of their clients. It's also worth noting the consequences of violating ethical standards can be very severe. Not only can it result in criminal charges and imprisonment, but it can destroy your career and destroy your reputation.
And get you kicked out of the country.
Absolutely. Overall, the case of Paul Harleman highlights the importance of ethical conduct in the accounting profession and the need for continuous reflection and evaluation of one's ethical values and responsibilities.
Very well said, Tom. And that's a wrap for today. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Take what you learned today and use the truths that hit home to transform the way that you do business. Tom and I are super grateful that you decided to join us today, and we hope you consider subscribing to the show and even sharing it with some friends who could use a Tax Crime Junkie podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more.
We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left and close them for good. Until next time, remember, every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.